And let's keep the international line open for those of you who live in Nova Scotia who might have information, about the Shag Harbor incident from 1967. We'll be back in a moment with your phone calls, and we'll talk a little bit about this bizarre story of reptilians wandering around New Orleans. Are you sure? We'll be back on Coast to Coast AM. Joe, before we take some more calls, we'll talk a little bit about Travis Walton this hour as well, but let's talk a little bit more about these reptilians wandering the streets of New Orleans. I mean, did a lot of people see this?
Actually, George, this was really, really weird. I had evacuated New Orleans and went to stay in Destin, Florida. And being a contractor, we decided to come back right as soon as they would let us back in,
sure,
which was about 4 days. Well, we loaded up with generators, scrolled back in the city. We were home about 4 days, had just got our house cleaned out, had the generators running, you know, doing the routine of living in the city in a disaster. And we get a phone call, okay, from a guy who's a National Guard, and he said that he seen, what he described was an amphibian-type reptilian walking through waist-deep water on Elysian Fields downtown New Orleans. Elysian Fields is right behind the old city. It's part of the Vieux Carré and the French Quarter. And the thing about it is, you know, it was him and three other National Guard guys that had seen it on this particular day. First, I found it interesting that someone took the time to find my phone number from downtown New Orleans in the middle of 7 days after Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
To call me about a reptilian. So I was kind of like, well, it can't be a hoax. So called the guy back, talked to him about it. About 2 days passed, and a gentleman from the New Orleans Police Department called, backing up what these four National Guard guys said they had saw. Altogether, there was four National Guard guys and three New Orleans police departments that said on at least three occasions they seen what appeared to be 6 to 7 foot tall lizard-like creatures with gills walking through the old city.
That's so bizarre.
Now, you know, all I can do is take these guys at their word. There's really nothing else I can do with this. None of them are willing to come on the air. I've asked all of them if they would be. I asked if I could use their names. One or two of them said that, from the National Guard, said they might allow us to post their information to the Internet. But that's as much as I can get them to do. So we have the account. We have the report. We have the names. We have the phone records. And I can't really see. First of all, I don't even know how they found this. I mean, there was no form of communications. I mean, there was no Internet at all unless you happen to have dial-up like we did or I still had high-speed cable, by the way. My cable didn't go out during Katrina. Neither did my phone line. But as soon as I hooked up the generator, we actually had all of that. But, I mean, these guys had to come off their duty, go find an Internet connection somewhere, look me up on the Internet, or look in the Times-Picayune logs because they had done a full-page interview on us down here, and find my phone number and call me to tell me about this.
Now, you're sure these weren't like scuba divers that they saw or anything like that?
No. The first account, from what they told me, is the National Guard, when they walked up on them, with M16s drawn, locked and loaded, walking up on these things. And they said as they approached them, they got this weird, strange feeling. And then the next thing they knew, they were walking away with their guns slung, but the aliens were still standing there. As far as I know, there was no form of communication or anything else. It was just they walked up on them with guns down, turned around and walked off with guns put up. So something happened. You know, there's a couple of seconds there that something happened, but that was it. And they were amazed by it. And they said, all seven of them said they felt compelled to report this. And I asked them how they found me. The one guy said it was just sheer coincidence. He had seen an old newspaper in somebody's derelict house. And there was the article. But I don't even know how the other guys found us. Those kind of coincidences are just really weird.
Well, and as you know, Joe, I don't believe in those. Synchronicity. Things happen for a reason. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to the international line, Joe. Let's see what that is. Maybe it's from Nova Scotia. Hello there.
Hi, George.
Welcome to the show. Are you from Nova Scotia?
I was in Nova Scotia in 1967. I happened to be in the Navy in 1967.
Ah.
Stationed at Halifax. But I didn't hear any scuttlebutt about that.
Nothing.
And usually, scuttlebutt goes around pretty quick.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it did happen. What it was, we don't know, but there was a major episode in October 67.
Right. I'll tell you who. Paul Hellyer was defense minister at that time.
Yes.
And he should know exactly what went on there.
Good idea.
Because, and it wasn't long after that, he was gone.
Well, and he's very vocal now about extraterrestrials.
Well, it seems funny that he's coming out wanting all the governments of the world to come forth with what they know, and he should be the first one. Because he was right there as defense minister. He would have first-hand knowledge of that.
All right, that's a great idea.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, George.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Have you ever talked to Paul Hellyer?
Actually, I met him, where was it? One of the conferences. I only got to talk to him for a short time. But
yeah, he's 83, but man, he is hot and heavy to get governments to disclose.
He does. But, you know, I was thinking what this gentleman just said. Would our government actually have told the Prime Minister of Canada what they were doing? They don't tell them now what they're doing.
I don't think so.
You know, that's the thing. I don't think they would have bothered telling them.
No, but he might have heard about the case.
He might have, yeah.
But it's interesting he didn't.
It would be interesting to ask him face-to-face or even on the air if he knows anything about it, just to get a permanent answer, you know, yes or no.
First-time caller line, you're up with us. Hello there.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi, George. This is Paul from Hillsborough, Oregon.
Hi. Thank you.
And I wanted to tell you about my UFO experience in England in about 1989 or 91. Some friends of me walked into a cathedral in Peterborough in England.
Okay.
And the cathedral was famous for Mary, Queen of Scots, and Catherine of Aragon were buried there. And we walked inside this big archway, and we looked up and saw this chrome object about 150 feet over our heads. It had an orange flame. Headed east over the cathedral and began maneuvering at high speed, zigzagging, and stopping immediately without slowing down and stuff.
How big would you estimate the object to be?
I'd say SUV-sized.
Okay. Small, generally, then.
Generally, yeah, but kind of small, about the size of an average vehicle or SUV. And when it departed to the south, and it was on the horizon in 2 seconds. It just shot off so fast.
And you kept saying to yourself, it's got to be a plane, but I know it isn't.
I think it's governmental or experimental aircraft. And I told some friends about it at home, and they said they heard it on the radio, actually. And the local Royal Air Force denied that it was anything to do with them.
All right,
and,
great.
Yeah, that's my story. I love you, sir. I've been trying to call you since 2001 about my OBE experience, which I'll email to you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for sharing that story. You know, I have heard, Joe, that Howard Hughes, back years ago, experimented and tested some kind of an aircraft that had clear wings because they were being used only as bombers. They couldn't land. Once they took off, they couldn't land. They had small little gear-type wheels in order to take off, but they were just to carry bombs and drop over enemy targets. But they had clear wings, so that would have made them look like cigars up above, you know, when you were looking at. Had you ever heard of that?
I had heard mention of a couple of things Hughes might have been working on. Somebody had referred us that about 7 or 8 years ago. It was an old NICAP member I had ran into had actually said something to me about that. And we both just said the same thing. Well, it would be cool if we could find a document or a piece of paper, you know what I'm saying? Because let's be honest, George, I would take care of like 15% of the UFO cases for about 10 years.
Sure would. Wild Card Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Good, sir. Thanks.
Pleasure to be on the show this evening. Well, I have a show this evening, and I have a theory as to why there maybe are not so many encounters anymore.
Okay. Love to hear it.
That they've completed their phase of testing and are now implementing their plans, through the NWO and Illuminati.
Well said.
For the upcoming 2012 changes that all the abduction has been about. You know, it's no longer necessary, perhaps, that testing for emotion frequencies, response and shock tests, et cetera, were all the purpose of feeding the data about us through their computers with the data that enables them to control us. You know, that they've been doing this for the upcoming microchip implantation to control our emotions and thus control mankind through a higher influence than the media.
What do you think, Joe? They're into a new phase, perhaps?
Well, the research suggests that they're pretty much going along the same thing. It just doesn't seem like they're showing themselves publicly as much. And I really think that has more to do with the education of the general population than it does anything else. I think that because there's so many of us out there educating the population now, ET's less likely to show their face because, let's be honest, everybody carries digital cameras, camcorders.
Hell, I think I got five of them I keep in my car alone. I really think it has more to do with that than anything else, even though I do think 2012 is a significant date, but I don't honestly know why.
November 5th, 1975, seven men working in a national forest. They tell a story of fear, shock, and confusion, the Travis Walton case. I've had Travis on the program before. He's compelling. He's passed lie detector tests. What the heck happened to him, Joe?
Travis was, I hate to say this like this, but he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he paid for it. And that's really what it is. In his case, I mean, and unfortunately for me, I got the case kind of reversed because we had heard about it early on and had looked into it, but I had never took the time to read his book. So I seen the movie before I read the book, which was a mistake on my part, ladies and gentlemen. Let me tell you about that. The thing about it is when I sat down and read the book and really got through it, and I started really investigating the case and finding out how well the lie detectors were done. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, they did a fantastic. I wish I could get this guy who did these tests. He was to the point, and he was well-credentialed. So maybe you could have got five guys together and really programmed them to lie. I'm having a hard time with that one. I think these guys honestly experienced what they experienced. I think Travis honestly experienced most of what he thinks. I don't know how much of it he recalls clearly and how much might be a fuzz, but I think he was too nosy for his own good. And what happened was is he walked up on that craft, and the way he says it, too, when I'm listening to him talk about it, and as a matter of fact, I've caught him interviewed on your show before, and the way he talks about walking up that ship, it just seems like, look, they kind of listed, okay, look, dude, you're getting close, and then, you got too close.
He got too close.
And that's really what it came down to, but it's kind of like, what's his name, Charles Hickson and Calvin, the Pascagoula case.
Yes.
You know, that's another one of simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Really, it was. I mean, they just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's not often you hear about these isolated cases, but for me, these are control group studies. If you're doing, and like in Pascagoula, you know, there's a large group of contactees that happen to live in the deep south along the Gulf of Mexico. These people are being contacted on a regular basis. Well, you want a non-contactee to check out your situation, a control study. There you go. They got him. They did it. They put him back. And I really think that had a lot to with Travis. I don't even think it was that. I think he was simply just being too nosy for his own good. I hate to say it like that, but I really do.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
My name is Bill. I'll tell you, you have a great show as always. Really good tonight.
Thank you, Bill.
I just want to comment on the Betty and Barney Hill story.
Sure.
I have two concerns with that. One, it wasn't reported until several years later, and they did it under hypnosis. And two, these abductions bother me because there's no compelling physical evidence, no paperwork, no hardware they bring back from the spaceships. And I'm wondering if these are just lucid dreams, and particularly when they put them under hypnosis, they're just recounting these very vivid dreams they have.
Well, they would both have the same dream, though?
Well, they were very close. They were husband and wife. They shared the same experiences. But I'm just wondering if it was not a very vivid lucid dream. See, I don't believe there's any aliens visiting us. I just believe it's an unexplained phenomenon that we just haven't come across the answer yet.
I'll let you take this, Joseph.
Well, let me start with the abduction thing first. So you know about 72% of all abductions happen during the daytime, usually on the drive to work or on the drive home. Most people are not even familiar with that. It seems to be more middle class rooted in the United States, too, by the way, middle and upper middle class for some reason, which is the controlling class. So it does make sense to me. The thing about it is they do happen like that. And if you can kind of try to, you know, put Betty and Barney Hill into the category where they were hallucinating. But the thing about it is in their case, being who they were, living in the era they did, coming forward could have been detrimental to them in a lot of ways. Hell, for that matter, they could have been stoned to death. And the thing about it is for them to do this, there was a driving force there. And the only thing I can think is if there was a driving force there, there was a physically real event that happened. It had to be something physically real to drive these two to put themselves out the way they did. They weren't making money on this. They weren't getting famous on it. It wasn't like it was going to pay their bills or anything else.
And they passed the lie detector test.
And they passed the lie detector test. And the thing of it is as far as Betty and Barney Hill is concerned, all the evidence suggests that there was a real physical event there. Like George and I were discussing earlier, it's what that event is. But the event itself was real. So knowing that, you can tell that it wasn't a hallucination or it wasn't hypnosis or anything along those lines. This was a physically real event. Now, as far as evidence versus an abduction, there is some. There's been footprints found at sites where there's been setups done while recording. Unfortunately, there's been no video evidence. I can tell you that. Not anything I would consider to be credible.
Weren't there some kind of magnetic circles or something on Barney's car at
the time? That was interesting you brought that up, because Stanton Friedman had mentioned something to me. You know, he used to work on nuclear aircraft for a living. That's what he did before he became a ufologist. And I actually did a show with him on that. And one of the things when you have like an EMP, a high impulse EMP, it's that magnetic field, the radiation can actually peel the paint off of a car. It'll break it. It's like hitting it with it's just like hitting it with a strong radio wave or a strong magnetic wave. It'll break it out and a little chip will come off and you'll have exposed metal. It'll take it all the way through to the primer and just leave the exposed metal. That's one of the other reasons I was kind of wondering about the Betty and Barney Hill case, because of the type of craft involved, because you just don't hear that in other craft. You've heard them hovering over cars and moving the whole car, but the paint stayed intact. So that tells you that was a different type of propulsion altogether.
So let's review. Shag Harbor, you believe there was some kind of real episode there.
Yeah.
You don't know what. You think it was extraterrestrial?
Oh, I agree. I think it was extraterrestrial. I wholeheartedly think Shag Harbor was extraterrestrial.
Betty and Barney, do you believe it was some kind of military intervention? You do not rule out, though, the fact that the military might have been working with some kind of extraterrestrial group.
Yeah, at this point, I would want to say that I would think this was a joint venture in Betty and Barney Hill. That it was both military and I think it was more military, but I do think the aliens were present during the abduction.
And the Travis Walton case, you think something major happened to them?
Oh, I think something major happened to him. I actually feel sorry for Travis, because he's one of these guys who, you know, he just was nosy. And the same thing I would do. I mean, if I seen a UFO hovering over the forest, I'm going to get out the car like a fool and walk over there and look at it. And which is what most curious people would do. So you can't really hate on him for it. It was a shame that it happened. But I do think it was a real physical event.
Tell us your websites again, Joe, before we take the break, sir.
That's www.icar1.com. That's the primary ICAR website. And you can always find us at www.paranormalradionetwork.com. That's where we broadcast from. So hop in and see us. And if you can't find us there, we're always in the ICAR UFO Alien Phenomena support group on Pal Talk.
How do people email you?
Oh, easy, icar@cox.net. Feel free. I check my emails every day. And if I'm not, I check all my emails personally, so you don't have to worry about it. If you send it to me, give me a couple of days to respond, because, you know, I do get a lot of email, but I will respond.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. Joe Montaldo, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, will take your phone calls. And don't forget the international line reserved for anybody else out in Nova Scotia that might have a little bit more evidence about the 1967 Shag Harbor episode. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I just got an email from someone who says they have tape of Betty Hill talking under hypnosis. So they're going to send me a copy of it. Let's hope I get it. And if I do, we'll put it on the air here on Coast to Coast. Our next guest tomorrow will be Chris Moon, a phenomenal show this is going to be, discussing Frank's Box. What is that? Well, it's known as the telephone to the dead. Maybe we'll make a call or two. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. Joe Maltado is our guest, and we will take your phone calls as well. Joe, the work you do continues. How do you get the abduction cases?
Well, through stuff like this, being on your show tonight, being on other shows, keeping the online support groups running. And it's just a matter of letting people know we exist. Like I've heard from several of my fellow ufologists, we're considered the best-kept secret in ufology. And people do find us. We do introduce ourselves at conferences. We work press at a lot of the different conferences when we're there, and we're attending and reporting. And, you know, we have a lot of ICAR members that will be present, and we'll have investigators present. And really, I mean, otherwise than that, there's no real other way to do it. And we're looking, actively seeking contactees for information reasons. Guys, y'all can help us. We can help y'all. I can be honest about this. You can come anytime you want to the online support group on Pal Talk and talk to these people. There's literally, on any given day, there's 20, 30, 40 contactees in that room at any given time. And you can stop and you can talk to them. They'll express their stories to you. You can tell them You can swap information. We also use it as a research medium. It works twofold. And we use that. My personal numbers are all listed on the Internet along with my 800 number for the organization. I'm very easy to get in touch with. All of my investigators are very easy to get in touch with. We're here. That's what we're here for, to find contactees. We are looking for similarities in contact cases. To the best of my knowledge, we are the only group this large that is doing a study this large. And we're literally looking for as many thousands of contactees as we can find. Now, we do understand we're going to go through 400,000 people to get 40,000 contactees, but we're willing to do it. And we're willing to do it out of our own pocket. We're not even asking you to send money. ICARS membership is totally free. Most ICARS funded by myself and a few other close friends of mine. And because we want to know the truth. And everything we learn, we want to share, at least as much as we can without giving the story away. For me, it's hard, George, because I got a border between what I can give away and what abduction criteria I need to keep.
Yep.
So I know who's telling the truth and who's not. And it makes it hard. Because personally, I'd like to just sit here and go down the list of everything we found in every abduction case that compares in all the cases. But then after that, anybody who called me could tell me they were an abductee, and it's really the only thing we have anymore to separate them. That and the simple fact of watching them, being with them, and working with them on a daily basis. And that's another thing, guys, that's something we guarantee. If you're a real contactee, and let me make this clear, if the organization investigates you and determines that you are a contactee, you have support anytime you need it. In a numerous number of ways. But, don't waste our time because it costs us a lot of money and a lot of time. I dedicate about 80 to 90 hours a week of my own time every week. If I did this for my company, I could have retired 5 years ago.
Absolutely. Let's go to some final calls. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, George?
Yes, sir.
Larry from Eagle Point, Oregon.
Hi,
talk with
Larry.
You before.
Sure. Thank you.
Betty and Barney Hill, this is really strange. A couple nights ago, I was thinking about Betty and Barney Hill, and now you're talking about it tonight. And the star chart did it for me, as far as I'm concerned. I've been studying. I've been an amateur astronomer since my mid-teens. When I was 18 years old and 61, I spent the whole summer, I never will forget this, my dad had a little tool shack out in the back, spent the whole summer learning the constellations, so I knew what was up there, and most of the satellites that were launched after that, I knew everyone, I could name them for you, so I knew what was up there, and I've seen 5 sightings myself, unfortunately nothing real close, but I call them UFOs, but I'm a little nervous, that's what I'm shaking, I'm like talking. But what I want to say, I don't want to be too long, but I've seen Betty on TV being hypnotized. I've read about her. Plain people don't know anything about astronomy. To me, that really affirmed my belief in extraterrestrials, even though I was made fun of. I was a nut because I believed in them, but I stuck to my guns, and I still do. And I'm not that far from Wright Pad Air Force Base. Nothing there, whole story. I won't get into that. But there's a lot of sightings at Wright Pad Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And I've been there. But what I wanted to say, besides Betty and Barney Hill, my ex-wife, I lived most of my life in Indiana. I'm out here in Oregon now, the last 3 years. She was ESP. She had ESP, definitely. And this wasn't ESP, but she was at a laundromat in Winchester, Indiana. That's where I was born and raised. And I have to tell you this. I think it's remarkable. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I believe, was put out in 69, I believe.
70s, I 70s. Think.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, sometime we were married. Well, we went to the movie, okay? This is before she saw the UFO. And we watched the movie. And I bet you it wasn't a few months later, she came home from the laundromat and says, Larry, says, I saw this UFO. It's pulsating lights. It was going around and around. We lived in a small town with a glass factory. It was hanging around this glass factory. And it took off, and my heart was beating 1,000 miles a minute. Anyway, we went after it, and, of course, it was gone. But she described it to me, and I says, describe it to me, and says, in the show, what it looked like, which one in the show. And she described it right to the T as one of the little ones that came out of the mothership. She described it right to the T, and she never made anything up. So I don't care what anybody says. As far as I'm concerned, I think the extraterrestrials have been here for thousands of years.
Well, some people believe we got seeded by them.
Yeah, there's all kinds of theories. But I think they've been here for a long time.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate you being on the program. By the way, Close Encounters, 1977. So he's a believer, Joseph.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, somebody asked me the other day, do you believe in extraterrestrials? I have to tell them no, because I don't believe. For me, it's a fact of life. I've seen the evidence. I'm convinced beyond any reasonable doubt. So it's not a belief system. And I tell people this all the time. Don't believe in E.T. Go out there, do your homework, and you'll find out it's a fact. You don't have to believe in it. And it's really one of the things we try to get across. We want people to educate. I tell people all the time, you can come listen to me speak every day. Don't take me at my word. Back it up. Look at the research. Do your own homework, because it's important that you learn this for yourself. Because that's the only way you're going to really understand that this is really going on, and it's the only way you're going to be able to want to stand up for it.
By the way, I need to get this out very quickly. Joe, anybody in British Columbia near the Kelowna, Kelowna airport, if there's anything unusual going on there, fast blast me as quickly as you can before I get off the air here. Would you? I appreciate that. I don't know what's going on. Somebody just called with something very strange. And just if you live in that area, if you can check it out, let's see what it might be. I'm not going to report on it until we can check it out. But hopefully you can send us the information. Let's go back to the phones. We shall go to our first time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, first-time listener as well.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm 44, grew up on the East Coast. And in the early 70s, we would visit family friends in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And we were kids. We would sit out on the roof of this little tool shed in the backyard of this family. And there was this one little redhead, freckle-faced kid, a son in that family, would stare up at those stars with us for hours, convinced that there were UFOs and other things up there. And his name was and is Larry Warren. And Larry is this guy, I don't know his whole story. He joined the Air Force, the United States Air Force, went to Great Britain somewhere. It was either in England or Scotland, and claims to have had a very close encounter. Do you know about his story, Joe?
I don't know. For some reason, it sounds familiar, but I hate to quote on something without having data in front of me because, honest with you, I look at hundreds of cases, so they all kind of, if I'm not looking at them per se, they kind of all go together.
Yeah, I have not heard of. Sometimes they don't use their real names.
Well, yeah, his real name is Larry Warren. And
Larry Warren from Rendlesham?
Yeah, that's the one.
Oh, yeah, I know Larry Warren. Actually,
with him, essentially. What do you make of his story?
You know, when Peter Robbins asked me to talk to Larry, I was kind of like, why not? It's Rendlesham. You know, he said he was there because what happens is I kind of believe what he's saying. I'm not 100% sure that everything he's saying is what he thinks it is. One of the things we learn with contact situations is we can only judge these situations by our own perception. And as humans, our perception is very limited, let me tell you. And so each individual is going to, sometimes they see things that are the same, but they describe them differently. And in his case, I think that's what's going on. But he's very convincing in the fact that what happened to him happened to him.
And, he stayed on his story for a very long time. He essentially seems even estranged from his family over it.
Yeah, he does. And he pretty much put his whole livelihood and reputation on the line for this. And he's fairly convinced. I mean, I haven't done enough research on him personally, you know, for a character judgment. But the two times that I've talked to him and the evidence he's presented has been pretty consistent, and it's not inconsistent with the rest of what went on at Rendlesham. It seems to fit in. It just seems to be another part.
When I tell you as children, we would sit and look up at the stars, and he was convinced then that he was going to see UFOs and have encounters. Does that tell you anything about someone's proclivity?
Well, it could, but in reality, I'm gonna say this bluntly: if you have an IQ 100 or over, you should realize that we are not alone in the universe. I mean, that is bottom line. And I mean, it's too big of a place with too many stars and too many planets. I mean, I'm listening to NASA and the European Space Agency. They're planning on finding life in 5 or 6 planets in our own solar system, much less in the rest of the galaxy. So for me, it's a given that there's life. The argument's always been, and even for science today, they're not really arguing that there's other life out there, or even intelligent life. The argument is, can that life get to this planet? And if it is, are they abducting our citizens? And if they are, is there anything we can do about it? And that seems to be where everything lies these days. So people like Larry Warner are important in the fact that they're willing to tell what happened to them. And they're credible enough that, you know, they're not some crackhead that's calling in and saying, I was abducted by aliens.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Appreciate that. I do have one report coming from Colonia, British Columbia in Canada, but I'm not going to go with this story yet. I cannot until I get some more corroboration on it. If you are in that area, if you can send me some information that may match what I'm seeing, I might be able to put this out. So if you live near the airport, just send me a fast blast. You will probably know what I'm talking about. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, what's going on, George?
Hi, good to talk with you.
My name's Hans. I'm from Imperial Beach, California.
Okay,
and
Hans.
I just wanted to mention that the History Channel last weekend had a thing on the Nova Scotia incident where they said they interviewed two Canada divers, and they went down and they seen the two ships locked together and the aliens on the outside of it. And they also said there was a lighthouse 10 miles from there that found a debris on the beach that was smoking and steaming. After the spaceship went into the water, he found debris that he had to give to the U.S. government.
That was that foam, I think. Was it not, Joe?
No, it was a big steel pipe on the shore by the lighthouse.
Oh, really?
Smoking,
okay.
Yeah. And he had to give that to the U.S. government, no questions asked.
Interesting. Now, did they come up with some kind of theory on what they think this was?
No, he thinks that it was something to do with some kind of fuel cell or something, but he wasn't told anything by the U.S. government. He had to give it to him, no questions asked.
All right, did he think it was an extraterrestrial craft as opposed to a military plane of some sort?
No, he says it's nothing that he's seen before, and he was an old man.
Yeah,
so.
Okay, that's a good hit. And Joe, did you ever come across something like that?
I heard about the phone, not physical wreckage. No, I mean, I heard rumors that the military may have recovered some physical records, but I didn't even hear anything about washing up on a beach. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to find a document trail to that.
We'll do that. We'll track down that History Channel report because it didn't get much publicity.
No, I try to keep up as much as them as I can. I don't know. I'll keep an eye out for it, too, because I'm kind of curious now.
Okay. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say that I really appreciate you and Mr. Bell a lot, and your open-mindedness and your investigativeness. And I had one question for your guest and one comment on the grave.
Sure.
I don't know if you know the answer to this question, because I know that you're really studying the abductee case. I really identify with what you said about you have to be completely stupid to believe that out of the trillions of planets in the universe, that we're alone, we're the only form of life. I have heard that there are 6 different known alien races that are in the process of dealing with us here on this planet. And if you knew what these 6 different races were, and if you could identify them.
Okay, now, but what I can tell you for sure is that we do investigate the Greys, the human-type aliens, and the reptilians.
Okay.
Supposedly, the Greys work for the light beams, which is a whole separate entity in itself. Then there's Charles Halls White. At first, I was kind of skeptical about these guys. I got to be honest. Recently, I've had some people, one from a Vegas casino, call me about seeing these things. Even says they can provide videotape from one of the. Now, if I can get my hands on this, don't worry, George, you'll be the first person I call. If I can get my hands on this, then maybe we can corroborate that particular type alien being here as well. And then there's another type that people describe, and I'm not sure how to really label these. They're probably some type of hybrid. Some people say it's a cross between the humans and the Greys, some between the reptilians and the Greys. No one really knows, but there does seem to be a hybrid type running around out there. Now, that's the ones that we mainly investigate and deal with. Then there's one other kind, these little short brown guys. Now, we've heard about these on about 100, 150 occasions. They say these guys actually eat humans.
Oh, my God.
Now, whether or not this is true, I have no way I can corroborate.
Sounds like a Twilight Zone movie.
Well, that's why I'm always real clear about this kind of stuff. You know, there is no way we can corroborate this. This is at best hearsay from contactees, but these 150 contactees did label these aliens the same type of alien, basically the same description, said they were very hostile towards human, and on at least half those occasions said there was human remnants present while they were there, you know, pieces and body parts. And that's all we can really say. I mean, there's no other way to corroborate it. I mean, there's just from the eyewitness testimony, and that's it, but... You know, that's the ones that we deal with the most. That's what we deal with. Now, I know a lot of people say there's 56 types and 72. The only evidence I've seen so far is for the ones we've just talked about. And the most evidence there is for the reptilians, the humans, and the grays. Those three type of aliens seem to be prominent. They seem to run back at least 10,000 years in our history, probably much further than that. And they've been with us. I mean, all you got to do is look at the Egyptian hieroglyphs or the Sumerian texts, and you'll know they've been with us for at least 6,000 years.
Been there. Joseph, we're out of time. I want to thank you for a great evening.
No, I appreciate it, George. I had a great time, and I appreciate the time coming on.
All right, Joe's website, and you can listen to his radio show. Just get the link at coasttocoastam.com. And I've gotten another report from Kelowna, and not enough to go with on the air, but I'll continue to follow up tomorrow. It could be nothing, could be a huge story. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbeth, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.